To call the meeting of the House Special Committee on Oil and Gas to order on Friday, the 23rd of March, 2007. It's 8:32. With us, we have Representative Mike Dugan, Representative Ralph Samuels, Representative Olson, our Vice Chair, Representative Nancy Dahlstrom, and myself, Dick Corry, the Chair of the Committee. Thank you very much for everybody's attendance. We're here to feedback from ExxonMobil in regard to the AGEA legislation, House Bill 177. And we thank you guys for taking time out of your schedules and coming here early in the morning to meet with us and to answer our questions. And we welcome you to the committee and would ask that you come forward, identify yourself, and give your presentation, and then we'll ask you any questions if we have any.
Sounds great. Would you like me to begin?
Please identify yourself.
Yeah. Well, Marty. Good morning, Representative Corry and members of the House Oil and Gas Committee. My name is Marty Massey. I am the U.S. Joint Interest Manager for ExxonMobil, a position I have held since November 2001. And in that position, I am responsible for the commercialization of the gas resources for ExxonMobil here in Alaska. What I would like to do is make some opening comments. If you want to stop me at any point in time and let's have a discussion about that particular topic, that's just fine, however you would like to deal with it, if that's okay.
That would be a good format. You make your opening comments, and then we'll ask questions for you.
Okay. ExxonMobil has been in Alaska for over 50 years and has been a key player in Alaska's oil industry development. We hold the largest working interest at Prudhoe Bay, and our current net production in Alaska is approximately 150,000 barrels of oil per day. We have benefited from our involvement in the state of Alaska, and we believe that Alaska has benefited from this long-term relationship as well. Commercializing Alaska's North Slope gas will allow us to continue this relationship for another 50 years or more. With that introduction, I'd like to take a moment to emphasize the importance of the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project to Alaska, to ExxonMobil, and to the nation. The project has the potential to generate billions of dollars in revenues for the state, the U.S. federal government, Canada, and could provide a stable and secure source of clean energy for Alaska and North America for decades to come. ExxonMobil supports efforts to advance a pipeline project, and we are ready to work with Governor Palin, her cabinet, and with the legislature to move forward the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project. Let me demonstrate the importance of this project to ExxonMobil. It has the potential to add over 1 billion cubic feet a day to our gas sales, which is just over 10% of our gas production that we produce today. It is leveraging for our business at ExxonMobil. Given the significant impact this project could have on our business, we are obviously very interested in progressing it. As an illustration of our commitment, ExxonMobil has spent more than $180 million studying ways to commercialize Alaska gas. Since the 1970s, we have evaluated LNG, gas to liquids, and gas pipeline alternatives. Based on these studies, we have determined that a producer gas pipeline project will result in the best value to the state, the producers, and the nation. It is important for me to say that ExxonMobil is aligned with the governor, the legislature, and the people of Alaska regarding the overall objective. We are committed to moving the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project forward. Because there is a perception that this is simply a gas treating gas pipeline project, the tendency exists for many to underestimate the size, magnitude, and risk associated with this undertaking. The Alaska Gas Pipeline Project is a world-scale undertaking with significant risk. In fact, the project would be the largest private investment in North America, significantly larger than most model worldwide oil and gas mega projects. There is not really another project that compares. Because of its size, many factors impact commercial viability. First, there's cost. Our previous estimate of $20 billion, that was in '01 dollars, is now substantially higher. Since 2001, steel prices have nearly doubled. industry, and construction labor costs are experiencing hyperinflation. In addition, worldwide mega projects are placing pressure on pricing and availability of global materials and skilled manpower. Next, there's gas price. Despite recent increases, natural gas prices remain highly volatile. The price of natural gas back in 2000 was less than the currently estimated gas treating and transportation costs for the project. Finally, there are many other risks. These include cost overruns, schedule delays, construction conditions, regulatory, and state fiscal uncertainties. It is important to note that project investments would have to be made 10 or more years before gas flows down the pipeline. With size comes complexity, an even greater premium on getting the design concept, contracting, and marketing plan right, and then executing those plans efficiently and effectively. Most importantly, size also amplifies the consequences of poor execution. If we make a mistake, we will all pay for it dearly. Let me make a few comments on how projects are financed and who bears the risk. Commercially sound oil, gas, and pipeline projects traditionally have been able to obtain financing if they have strong sponsors, proven track records, and the financial strength to provide sponsor equity, put up funds into the project, and to backstop key project commitments. For Alaska Pipeline Project, the key project commitments will take the form of long-term gas transportation commitments, firm transportation commitments, and we often shortchange this and call it FT, are binding obligations made by companies, we call them shippers, to pay for the cost of reserving a quantity of gas capacity on a pipeline over a specified period of time, usually many years. These commitments are made during an open season, which according to FERC Order 2005 for the Alaska Gas Pipeline is a period of at least 90 days, during which any and all prospective gas shippers can make binding commitments for a specific volume of transportation capacity. Financial institutions generally require substantial long-term firm transportation commitments to provide funding for a pipeline project. These commitments must be provided by creditworthy shippers. In this case, the shippers will be the producers, and directly or indirectly the state, or the state shipper. And these firm transportation commitments are substantial. They're in tens of billions of dollars. They must be paid whether the shipper making those commitments actually transports the gas through its reserve transportation capacity. The shipper is also required to pay this commitment regardless of the gas price in the market. Pipeline investors use these firm transportation commitments from shippers to show creditors that they have the capacity confirmed over a sufficient duration to secure financing, and must rely on the financial strength of the companies backing those commitments to secure the financing. They will basically look through the pipeline company to the shipper that made the commitment to determine the financial strength behind that commitment. Thus, the development cost and the associated overrun risk are ultimately borne by the shipper via this commitment. In other words, shippers must make these long-term shipper-paid transportation commitments and agree to pay the transportation and treating rates that are based on the ultimate cost of the pipeline and treating facilities. It's the final cost that it will be based on. The only information known in advance of making these commitments will be a projection of the cost based on the project entity's time, their estimated cost at the open season. It's our view, for that reason, the parties taking the risk need to be able to manage the risk. The producers as shippers cannot make firm transportation commitments during open season unless they are confident the gas pipeline project can be built cost effectively and also operated on a long-term, commercially viable basis, including being competitive with other sources of gas supply. This is especially true for a project of this magnitude. Maximizing the value to the state of Alaska and the resource holders means selecting the right design concept for this mega project and then executing the project at the lowest cost. On a mega project of this size and magnitude, project construction and operating experience should be a significant consideration. Only a limited number of companies have demonstrated the capability and financial strength to effectively participate in and manage world-scale mega projects.
Would you repeat that, Mr. Chair? That sentence?
Only a limited number of companies have demonstrated the capabilities and financial strength to effectively participate in and manage world-scale mega projects.
Thank you.
The producers have this experience on numerous projects worldwide and have demonstrated success in meeting project objectives. For example, ExxonMobil operates in nearly 200 countries and territories and on every continent except Antarctica. We are the world's largest non-government producer of both oil and natural gas. ExxonMobil's global project development company is unique within the industry. This global development company leads the industry in project cost and schedule performance. Over time, our development costs are 25% lower than the industry average on a dollar per barrel basis. Nearly 90% of our projects with costs greater than $1 billion are delivered within 15% of the estimated costs at the time of project funding. And nearly 80% of those were delivered within 15% of the funding schedule. ExxonMobil's superior performance was independently validated in a report published by Sanford C. Bernstein. On this topic of project delays, the report stated, ExxonMobil came out on top of this analysis with the lowest slippage rates despite undertaking some of the largest projects. We believe this to be a direct result of its highly competent internal development company, which assumes full responsibility for monitoring a new project from idea to profit. Combining our capability with BP and ConocoPhillips will provide the best chance of delivering a successful project.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Massey. Could we get a copy of that? That
sure.
Report?
You bet.
Thank you.
Before I continue, excuse me for interrupting you, sir. By the way, I'm really enjoying your presentation. It's very well written in layman's terms, and it's very understandable and well articulated. This is refreshing to have such a good report, and I'm actually feel like I'm benefiting from what you're presenting to us, so thank you for that. We've been joined by Representatives Ramirez, Jay Ramirez, and Representatives Scott Kawasaki. We've got some of our colleagues. I don't mean to embarrass you, ladies and gentlemen, but do want to honor my colleagues here, Representatives David Guttenberg and Craig Johnson is back there somewhere, at least I saw him a short while ago, and Berta Gardner. It's one thing I really appreciate about this effort. It's been a real unified effort on the part of the legislature between the Senate and the House and minority majority, and it's great to have this this all-inclusive effort here. We're all Alaskans, regardless of our parties and statuses in the legislature here, and I see us coming together in a real good way. So
right.
It's real encouraging to see that.
So. Thank you, Representative Corrine, and I'll be happy to give you a copy of this. It's got a number of notes that I've made, so I need to go back and give you a final copy, but I'll be happy to.
Thank you, Maury. Go ahead.
The producers also have Arctic experience in Alaska and throughout the world. ExxonMobil's Arctic experience is extensive, over 40 years, with developments in multiple types of Arctic environments. Our Arctic offshore activity started in 1966 with the installation of the ice-resistant Granite Point platform in Alaska's Cook Inlet and still producing oil today. In the 1970s, we provided a significant amount of research and engineering for the Prudhoe Bay project, where our completion designs for permafrost were of key importance to the project. We also developed the combined hydraulic flow model and thermal simulator on which the design of TAPS was based. In 1984, we installed the concrete island drilling system, or SIDS as it's been known, to drill exploration wells in the Alaska Beaufort Sea. This was the first mobile drilling platform to operate in the ice-covered waters of the Beaufort. In addition to our Arctic experience in Alaska, ExxonMobil also has extensive Arctic experience in Canada, developing the Norman Wells field in the McKenzie River area near the Arctic Circle. Offshore Newfoundland, We completed the Hibernia platform. That's the first and only iceberg-resistant offshore structure in the world. In Russia, we recently started up the Sakhalin 1 development, which involved an offshore platform where SIDS was refurbished, named Arlen, and put in place. An onshore drill site where we have set new industry limits for extended reach drilling. An onshore oil and gas plant with a capacity of 250,000 barrels per day. And purpose-built tankers, which are used year-round. All of this work being done in the Arctic environment in a very seismically active area. At Sakhalin, we're currently producing 250,000 barrels a day, so we've met the capacity of that development. I hope you see from these examples that large projects with significant complexity is what we do, and we are extremely qualified to take on this work. These successful efforts were the result of a long-term commitment to technology development, which has played an important role in the advancement of oil and gas here in Alaska. ExxonMobil believes innovation is the key to meeting the world's energy challenges. Technology is the lifeblood of our industry, and it always has been. We are the leader in our industry in technology development. 2006, we spent $730 million on technology development. We spent more than $3 billion since 2002. In addition, ExxonMobil has demonstrated world-class leadership in safety, health, and environmental performance. ExxonMobil is a leader in operating efficiency and a pace setter in operating safety. Our total recordable incident rates for employees and contractors are substantially below the average of U.S. petroleum industry benchmark of API companies. We believe a company's commitment to the highest standards of safety, health, and environmental care manifests itself in superior performance in all aspects of its business. Basically carries through everything that you do. It is important to remember that Alaska Gas Pipeline Project is a basin-opening project that will benefit the state and the oil and gas industry in Alaska. We opened the basin to oil. Now we're talking about opening the basin to gas. Basin-opening projects throughout the world have progressed, and they've been successful when there is alignment between the host government and the leaseholders. That means the state of Alaska and those that hold the leases, which is ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, for majority of the gas. The producers in the state both want a pipeline project to commercialize the known ANS gas resource and open the basin to gas exploration. So when you look at this at a very high level, we are aligned. We believe a producer gas pipeline project will result in maximum value to the state and the producers. The reason is the producers in the state have the maximum incentive to control costs, low capital and operating costs, which results in lower treating and transportation costs, and access to premium markets results in a higher netback value on the gas. It should be noted that the state will receive the majority of its revenue from the value of the gas. Be your revenues received under its royalty agreements or from production taxes, which are valued based on the netback received from gas. Third-party owners do not share the same incentives in that they actually benefit from increased capital costs. Based on the demand for workers that this project will generate, Alaskans are obviously key to successful project execution. Both the state and the producers want Alaskans to benefit from the many job opportunities that will exist. When you consider carefully the options available, we believe a producer pipeline will provide maximum value to the state of Alaska. For us to progress the project and mitigate its inherent risk, we do need some things from the state. Because of the nature and magnitude of the risk associated with this project, billions of dollars of financial commitments, as I mentioned, unprecedented cost and scope, potential for construction delays, as well as the inevitable risk associated with the price of gas, fiscal terms that are predictable and durable are necessary. As with all of our other major mega project investments, and we share this with the resource owners where those investments are to be made, we are willing to take the geology risk, we are willing to take the cost risk, and we are willing to take the commodity price risk. But we cannot take the risk of fiscal terms changing. Let me expand on this important concept further. The first two risks, geology and costs, are risks that by, you know, by which we have developed what we think an industry-leading expertise to manage. We're willing to take those on. That's what we do day in and day out at ExxonMobil, managing those risks. Market risk is inevitable in a commodity business such as oil and gas. We do manage that risk by trying to place our products in the best value markets. Fiscal risk, however, is a completely different nature. It's totally outside of our control. We must have agreements that allow us to develop this mega project under predictable and durable terms so that we can make an adequate investment decision. If fiscal terms can be changed in the future, then we are not able to make a well-founded investment decision on behalf of our shareholders. The Alaska Gas Pipeline Project will require massive investments to be made 10 or more years, as I said, before any revenue is generated. As a result, increases in taxes on oil and gas-related activities during the life of the project could significantly impact the commercial viability of the project. And it could offset the benefits of taking on a project of this magnitude. Because fiscal terms could be modified under the proposed AGEA legislation, it does not provide the fiscal stability necessary to ensure a commercially viable project. Development of a predictable and durable fiscal framework means that the terms agreed between the producers and the state recognize the magnitude and the risk associated with the project, balance the state and producers' needs, and provide for the calculation of total state take in a transparent and predictable manner. With that background, I would like to now give some feedback on AGEA, which is based on the conclusions and the principles I've mentioned. I will also outline our thoughts on how AGEA should be modified to provide the best chance of a successful result. For example, alignment between the state and the leaseholders is essential to a basin opening project of this magnitude. Therefore, establishing the right approach going forward is most important activity for the project at this time. It is important that AGEA bring together the upstream and the midstream and provide for an integrated proposal. Let me expand on this point. The upstream and the midstream at some point will have to come together. The reason is simple. The upstream pays for the midstream. And when I say upstream, I mean the revenue generated from the sale of the gas and liquids from the pipeline project. To be able to calculate the revenue from the upstream, we must have clarity on the taxes and royalty from our oil and gas operations, and the taxes and royalties must be set at a level that makes the project viable. In order to ensure a viable project from the outset, we believe this must be done at the beginning. At a minimum, any proposal should demonstrate how a successful open season would be achieved. Also, it is important that AGEA allow applicants to define how they could achieve the state's objectives, rather than prescribing specific requirements that must be met. To ensure the best result, AGEA should establish broad key objectives and allow applicants flexibility in meeting those objectives by providing requirements they feel are necessary to make the project commercially viable. For example, we think it would be better to let the applicant determine whether or not they require any capital contribution from the state. ExxonMobil recognizes the importance to the state, explorers, and others of having access to the project so that their gas can be treated and transported to markets. To ensure that a project is constructed, it must be commercially attractive to the shippers at the time they make that firm transportation commitment. Shippers, particularly those who must invest substantially to explore for, develop, and produce gas resources, will not be willing to enter into long-term financial commitments for the transportation of gas if they believe there is a substantial likelihood that their initial rates will be significantly increased in the future in order to accommodate expansions. Under the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act, Congress struck what it determined was the proper balance between encouraging investment by those willing to commit to pay for the initial capacity and encouraging exploration by providing an opportunity for future access to the pipeline. Because of the unique nature of this pipeline project, FERC approved unprecedented policies, to enable a FERC-mandated expansion benefit explored for future shippers. The issue of how potential future shippers may access initial capacity and future expansion capacity, if needed, should be administered by FERC for all elements of the project in the United States. For example, shippers or producers should not be required to subsidize other expansion gas holders at 115% of the initial maximum rates due to a mandated roll-in of expansion costs. For example, this 15% increase could increase my FT commitment effectively by 30 to 50 cents per MBTU on gas shipped. This is an increase of $500 to $800 million per year on the initial shippers. That includes the state. This could also you could also consider this a subsidy to the expansion shipper. This is too high of a risk to take. In addition, the pipeline entity should not be required to accept a FERC certificate irrespective of FERC-imposed conditions.
Marty, excuse me for interrupting. We do have a question from a member here, Representative Ramos.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's so nice to see you. And I'm a proud shareholder of Exxon. I'm very happy about that. Just because there's going to be so many big pieces, could you just stop with the roll-in rate part and explain the mathematics of how that would be so much more expensive once you make your FT, how that would have such a negative impact? Just broad mathematics. Just take me through that, please.
Sure. Representative Ramers, through the chair. The example that I quoted was based on an initial shipper has made his FT commitment. That tariff to Chicago could be in the range of $2.50. At today's cost, it could be as high as $3.50 okay. to $4. And then if you're required to basically roll in 15%, you could basically take that 15% on that tariff, and that will give you an indication of what the increased cost is. So 15% of $2.50 or 15% of $3.50, you're going to get 30 to 50 cents, roughly, as the cost. Multiply that by how much gas that you're shipping, and you get the extra cost that you're required to pay on a yearly basis.
I'm sorry, just quick follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Ramirez.
But if you were going to be one of the people that you found more gas with your leases and you were nominating more Exxon gas into the pipe, you arguably could be the beneficiary of the rolled-in rate. When Exxon goes back into the pipe with another large discovery that's made in the year 2020, for instance, you could equally argue that Exxon, as a comer for a second piece, would be the beneficiary of the rolled-in rate for any new FTs that you made at that point. Is that also correct, just theoretically?
Representative Ramers, through the chair, that is theoretically correct, and I hope we do find.
I expect we will.
A big field, and I hope ExxonMobil is the one that finds it. But what we're talking about here is should we mandate that at this point in time, or should we leave it open for every party to go to FERC and propose what they want to see done? Then if there cannot be an agreement between the parties, which I hope there could be, in most cases there probably will, agreement will be reached in terms of how the pipe should be expanded, then we can go to FERC. FERC does this sort of thing, and they can make a decision about what's in the best interest of all the parties, including the initial shippers, the pipeline, and the expansion shippers.
Thank you, Marty. Representative Samuels, and then we'll skip Ralph for now, and then we'll go to Representative Elster.
Thank you, Mr. Massey, for being here. So am I hearing you say that you feel that the decision should be removed from the state of Alaska and the legislature to FERC, that they should make those decisions?
Representative Dawson, to the chair, yes, that's what I'm saying. FERC has the responsibility. FERC will make the decision regardless of what we write into our contract. FERC will make that decision. They have the authority to do it. So it doesn't really matter what we write in our contract. They will do it.
Thanks for that clarification.
Thank you very much, Senator Elsman.
Shall I continue?
Yes, please.
As I discussed previously, with regard to the upstream terms, the proposed upstream inducements included in AGIA would require significant modification to ensure a commercially viable project is obtained. It would be better to leave that issue open for now and allow an applicant to make a proposal to address those necessary terms. AGIA also prescribes activities that must be completed within a specific time frame or date certain. Setting arbitrary target dates is not consistent with good management practices. Further milestones are not necessary if the project is commercially viable. The producers will progress the project at the maximum prudent pace, consistent with industry-proven gate process for project development.
Excuse me, Marty. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Massey, one of the problems is the perception that if somebody does not want to build the project, if you don't put the milestone in there, if you don't put a gate that they have to jump to, the open season must take place in this time frame. So how do we have assurances? And I understand, you know, we all saw the IPA presentation where if you put an artificial timeline in there on a mega project, then they don't work. Do that. So how do we get assurances that we will actually continue down the road into your scenario that something will actually happen without us pushing the ball forward and saying, okay, you have to have the open season, you must do these things on timelines? How do we get assurances then as Alaska that whoever the applicant is, whether it be a third party or whether it be Exxon or a consortium of various entities, that they actually don't just get the license and go, thanks, I've got you now. And you don't. How do we force you to do something then if we don't have a timeline?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, forcing someone to do something that doesn't
in strenuous terms.
Asking someone to do something that doesn't make sense just will never work, especially on a project of this magnitude. It has such a big impact on the companies. It's a big impact on our company, and we're big. We just can't be forced to do something. The standard that I would propose is we need to be diligent. And if we're not diligent in pursuing the project, then something needs to happen. Something needs to happen. We either lose the contract or there's something else that occurs, which, you know, we maybe can have some dialogue and come up with something. Maybe there's something around the early front of the project that you can require. We were willing in the last contract to enter project planning, and we were also willing to make a decision on whether to go to the open season process. So we made that commitment up front. So that, I think that's how I would answer your question. It must be some sort of, has to have some sort of diligent expectation. And if someone doesn't think they're diligent, they take them to a third party and you make a decision on that, were you diligent or not. In general, AGIA lacks specific on key fiscal terms and other requirements. To address these gaps, AGIA gives commissioners broad authority to adopt additional requirements and establish regulations. Not knowing these requirements now creates significant uncertainty. AGIA also does not establish criteria for evaluating proposals and selecting the successful bidder, which is likely to lead to litigation from project proponents not selected for the inducements.
Say that again, please, Mr. Chairman.
AGIA also does not establish criteria for evaluating proposals and selecting, you know, the successful bidder, which is likely going to lead to litigation from the proponents not selected for the inducements. Finally, because of the complexity and risk associated with this project, the parties must have an efficient and impartial means of handling disagreements. We believe project-related agreements should provide for binding neutral arbitration as a mechanism for resolving disputes. Binding neutral arbitration is widely utilized in the U.S. and international commercial agreements and is not a new concept within the state of Alaska. Arbitration is the method to resolve disputes under the state's royalty settlement agreements. In addition, Alaska courts have recognized a strong public policy in favor of arbitration. In closing, I would like to reiterate that ExxonMobil is committed to moving the gas pipeline project forward. Our company possesses the financial strength and the project experience required to make this project a success. We are ready to work with the administration and the legislature to establish a framework that recognizes the integrated nature of the project and mitigates the risk I've discussed. We would suggest the GIA be amended to include the broad objectives the state wants to achieve and allow each applicant to decide how best to meet these objectives and to identify what is required from the state to advance the project. The state can then accept the proposal that delivers the most value. We are ready to participate in a competitive, open, transparent process under the approach I've outlined. Thank you for your attention and for the opportunity to address this important topic today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Massey, thank you very much for that very good presentation, and I appreciate the fact that you didn't fly over 20,000 feet as we had seen in previous presentations. In other words, you gave a few more specifics than we've seen in the past, and we do appreciate that, and for recognizing that we have a good piece of legislation before us, even though it does need some tweaks here and there. I think most of us agree to that, but we got a good basis to work with, so thank you for your thoughts. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, just for the benefit of the members, sometimes just myself around this building, you see a lot of people from BP, you think BP is big. Conoco, you see a lot of people from Conoco, you think Conoco is big. For the record, Mr. Jardel, who's taken over here, is doing a splendid job. He's highly visible, and I think he's effective at communicating the Exxon mobile message. But he's, along with Mr. Pulliam, often in the building, you know, by himself. But he's doing a splendid job. But I wanted to share with the members, and I passed out sometime before to some of the groups that came through here a speech that Rex Tillerson made. He's the new CEO of Exxon. And while some of the other oil companies have been committing to pursuing alternative energy strategies, Exxon has recommitted to the development of gas and oil. They are the Walmart of the planet Earth when it comes to developing energy. They are huge. They are the largest market cap of any company. They have earned more money in a 90-day period, in a quarter, in a year, than any other company on the face of the earth in the history of civilized mankind. And so I worry, and this isn't leading to any kind of a gotcha, Mr. Massey. I'm just really just trying to share this. I feel like Alaskans tend to view our gas line regionally, as in what is good for Alaska. Or we see it in the context of moving our gas from the North Slope to the lower 48, to this North American market, whether it's Alberta, or whether it's Chicago, or whether it's down to Valdez and to West Coast LNG terminals. But the fact is that Exxon, as Mr. Massey has said, is a global company doing business in 100 different countries. They are worth, I think, about $400 billion today, and half they have invested in hard dollars, half of that market cap in the last 15 years, opening up markets around the world. ExxonMobil has and I'm trying to be artful about this because Mr. Jardel's doing a great job, but sometimes Exxon is not as visible in this building, and we all just can't help but to measure things by who we see in this building, and it kind of personifies that company. But Exxon is a monstrous, huge and effective company, and I am very anxious to have you come back to the state. By just anecdotally, I was at the governor's prayer breakfast a couple of weeks ago, and Cal Worthington Jr. was talking about how many Exxon guys are buying Mercedes in the Anchorage area, and I said, well, there's only 13 of them in the state. He said, oh no, they're coming in droves. There's a lot of Exxon people. So I don't know whether you're increasing your workforce here, but I'm very happy about AGEA. I think it's a brand new process. I think it's fresher. I think it's more open. It's more transparent. It will benefit from a lot of changes. I intend to introduce some. I'm glad that we focused on the criteria, and because that's a critical thing that we've recognized here. I I want to move this gas, and I think that that Exxon is the company to help do it. I applaud you for being here. I applaud you for being open and ready to discuss this with specifics, as the chairman noted. Exxon is powerful, and one of the phrases that I heard you say is that you're big and you can't be forced to do this. And I hope that the administration and this body is mindful of that delicate balance, that we want to bring you in and to have you fully participate, but that we cannot make a large company like you do something, because you're as big as, I mean, you'd be a country. And so I'm mindful of that. So I'm glad that we are approaching it with that sensitivity. It's a new day. I'm happy that Exxon's here, and I'm happy that we have a new proposal before us, and I hope that we can modify it and make it conform to your needs and to the state's needs, and that we can unlock these hydrocarbon molecules and move them to a vibrant marketplace. So thank you very much for your presentation this morning.
Amen to that. Thank you, Representative Ramos. We'll go to Representative Zahlstrom, and then Dugan, and then Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Mr. Massey, for being here. I do want to put on record, and Representative Ramos kind of referred to it, we as a committee are looking at the criteria that are stated and some things that are not stated, and we'll be presenting some things in the near future on strengthening that. So I want you and everyone else listening to know that is something that we are working on. I appreciate the commitment that you have. I know your company is successful. You made a comment that about how much money had been since 1992, $3 billion had been spent on oil production. Can you give me a broad figure of how much of that was spent in Alaska?
Representative Dawson, through the chair. The $3 billion figure that I quoted was related to our investment on technology.
Okay.
In Alaska, our capital investments through our operations at Prudhoe and so forth are in the range of $150 to $200 million a year.
Per year?
Per year.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair. And then the thermal model that you talked about, which you developed that TAPS is based on, is that something that your company has patented?
Representative Austin, through the chair, it was done quite a few years ago, as you imagine, and technology has moved well beyond that now, and there's industry models out there that are available that do a good job in that particular area. I would like to comment, if you would, on criteria for just a second.
Please do.
I didn't provide a lot of specifics in that area, and just to give you some insight into how we view criteria. I mean, we go out for bid all the time for work, and when we look for bids and we try to judge who to select, the first priority is can they do the work. Normally we won't even go out to bid to anyone unless we've made a judgment that they can do the work, can they actually do the project. And some of the things you look at in that category are their financial strength. Do they have the financial strength to do it? Second, you'll look at what's their project experience and capability. Do they have a proven track record? Have they demonstrated the ability to do these things? Then we would look at their safety, the environmental integrity performance, because as I mentioned, we believe safety is a good indicator of how well the company does everything that they do. So if they've got a good safety record, then you're getting a company that probably executes well also. And then the last thing I would say in regards to this project is you need to make sure that the person or the company you select can deliver a successful open season. If they can't deliver a successful open season, then you're in a high risk of a failed result. So I would put all of that in the category of picking the right company. Then the second criteria would be, what is the value to the state? How much money does this proposal deliver to the state versus other proposals? Obviously, you're interested in getting money to pay for doing activity here in the state. Well, that's got to be right there at the top. And then third, how well does this applicant meet all the other criteria, objectives that I have? Are they committed to hiring Alaskans? Do they have a good Alaska hire plan? Are they going to provide access to the gas in the state? Do they have a good plan for expansions? Have they convinced us that the pipe will be expanded so that explorers can get their gas to market? How well do they meet all those objectives? And that's why I would say a GIA should be modified such that what you describe are those broad objectives, and give the applicant the flexibility to decide how best to meet those broad objectives. And then once you get their proposal, you can weigh up all of those things. You know, can they execute the project? What's the value they have to the state? And then how well did they meet my other objectives that are so important for me? Once you see how they're doing that, then you will have in my view, from the competitive process, you'll be able to pick which one.
Just a final follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you. One of the things you stated early on, too, was when you were talking about the things that are important to you when you make decisions on who you're doing business with, the final thing you said was state fiscal uncertainty. Could you expand a little bit? Are you meaning you're getting that feeling from what AGIA states presently, or you have that feeling about the state of Alaska as a whole? And then that's my final question, Mr. Chair, but when we're done with questions, I would like to ask Commissioner Galvin to come up for some additional questions, too. Yeah. So if you could respond, please. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Dawson to the Chair. AGIA in its current form does not provide the necessary, you know, predictable and durable terms to have a commercially viable project. And when I say predictable and durable terms, I'm talking about the upstream part of that, the oil and gas taxes, the royalty, that property taxes, state income taxes are not basically well defined. What we're trying to define between us is a business arrangement that's going to last for many years, and we're trying to define how we're going to split up the revenue associated with that project. And that's what we mean by predictable and durable terms. We need to write down, you know, how we're going to split that revenue up, you know, for the life of the project. On mega projects like this, as I mentioned, there are a number of risks. You got the geology risk, you got the cost risk. We'll take on those risks, but we can, and we'll take on the price risk, because that's a commodity business. There's really nothing we can do about that. But we can't take on the risk for a project of this nature that the fiscal terms are going to change.
One more follow-up?
Can I, excuse me, Mr. Chair, renege on, I said my final. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Massey, could you give me, you've stated some specific things, but can you give me even a couple more specifics on what would mean predictability and to you, to your company?
Well, what I would say is I know the state has struggled with this particular question of, you know, locking in, if you will, the oil and gas taxes. What I would propose is that you not mandate that in AGIA, that you let each applicant describe what is necessary for commercial viability, for fiscal stability, predictable and durable terms. And then once you get all of the different proposals, you can weigh that up and see what's acceptable or what's not acceptable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dahlstrom. And I appreciate the patience of the members here. There's several more questions here that are lining up. Before we get to Mr. Galvin, I would like to go to the other members.
That'd be great.
If that's okay. We'll go to Representatives Dugan, followed by Samuels and Olson. Mike?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a couple questions, too. I appreciate the fact that this has been a very simple and clear presentation, so simple and clear that I thought I understood most of it, which is probably dangerous. I just wanted to make sure I understood your answer to Representative Dahlstrom's last question. You're proposing a system in which essentially the applicants for the license are going to say, we think that the state's tax rate needs to be X for Y years, and describes in some kind of detail like that the royalty considerations as well. Is that correct?
Representative Dugan, through the chair, that's exactly correct.
Okay.
And can I expand on that a bit?
Please.
The PPT gas rate that's currently, in the GIA is too high. It will not result in a economic or viable project. So what we're suggesting is that remove the prescription from a GIA, let the applicant propose how they're going to meet your objectives, what do they need to make the project go forward, and you weigh up those competitive proposals. You can select the one that meets that criteria that I laid out, and I'm sure you have others as well that you would add to the list. If you don't like it and you don't want to go forward, then say no. If you like one of the proposals, select that one and let them go to work. We believe we can compete very favorably in that process, and we'll give you a very favorable proposal.
If I might continue, Mr. Chairman. I think I understand how that would work if the producers are going to also be applying for the license. It's not quite so clear to me how a pipeline company, which isn't one of the producers, would be able to basically tell the state what they think the producer's tax and royalty rates should be. So how would that work?
Representative Dugan, through the chair, pipeline companies understand economics. They understand commercial viability. There's no reason why a pipeline company couldn't approach us in terms of what we would be willing to propose to them for our gas to make their project viable. If they feel like we're not dealing with them fairly, then at a minimum they can propose what they think should be included in the proposal that would result in a successful open season. The key here is that you've got to make sure whoever you select, you will have a successful open season, and they should be required to demonstrate in their proposal how it will result in a successful open season.
Marty, I got to tell you, I just don't see how that's going to work. Because I think what you just told me is that your competitors in proposing for the pipeline could come to you and ask you for a key piece of information that would be part of the evaluation of the proposals, and you would give it to them. Maybe that's possible, but it seems to me that if the producers were actually trying to get the pipeline, they really wouldn't want to be telling their competitors what was going to be in their proposal.
Representative Dugan, through the chair, I mean, it's been pretty obvious already what we need to progress the project. We've demonstrated that to us. Should not be a surprise to anyone. And if they don't think we're dealing fairly with them, then they can make their own proposal on what should be in the upstream.
Okay.
I understand it is it's a difficult situation because we have the lease, and that's the situation we deal with. That's what makes this project complex. Mm-hmm. It does give us an advantage, and we need to find a way to work through that such that you're comfortable that advantage has not been misused.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may not even be a question, but I'm just trying to understand the dynamic of what you're proposing here. So under this system, the state, whoever it is, the commissioners in this case, let's just leave the rest of the bill the way it is for the purposes of this question. The commissioners would get these proposals. They would pick a licensee. Then they'd have to come back to the legislature for whatever changes needed to be made in the tax and royalty regime for the producers that are suggested in or that are spelled out in the proposal. I think. Have I got that right? I mean,
Representative Dugan, through the chair, I think you absolutely have it right. And we would not propose anything different than that. In fact, to ensure you have the best case to pass a constitutionality test, we believe there should be enabling legislation. And there's a proposal that is made, and then the legislature needs to approve that proposal.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I have another question that is only going to reveal my level of ignorance here, so I apologize. but when fiscal certainty seems to be the term we use for taxes and royalty payments, is the state the only governmental entity in which those considerations come into play when we're thinking about the construction of a pipeline?
Representative Dugan, through the chair. It is our principle at ExxonMobil that when we are trying to bring a project forward, the terms under which we are developing that project should be discussed and resolved with the original resource owner, because it is the resource that's ultimately going to pay for the project. In this case, the state of Alaska is the resource owner, and therefore we need to have a deal with you that makes the project viable. And it's perfectly acceptable for the resource owner to decide what they're willing to do or not willing to do. And that's the discussion we need to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understood that, Marty. I guess I should ask a simpler question. Does the federal government have taxing authority on this project? Does the Canadian government have taxing authority on this project? Would there need to be discussions on fiscal certainty with either the United States government or the Canadian government or the provincial governments? What I'm trying to get at is, are we the only, setting aside the royalty question, are we the only taxing jurisdiction that this would have to be done with?
Representative Dugan, that's a good question, and the federal government will get their piece of this. The Canadians will get their piece of this, but they're not the resource owner. The resource owner is the state of Alaska, and our principle is if we're going to make this investment viable, it's the resource owner and the leaseholder that needs to come together to define the terms that make it viable, not some other taxing entity.
Thank you. Marty, I understood that the first time you told it to me, I think. The question I'm trying to get at is this. The state is the resource owner, and that affects what its royalty laws might be. It's also a sovereign. That affects what its taxation policy might be. If there are other jurisdictions that also are taxing, is Exxon attempting to get them to freeze their taxes as part of this project? Or is the state of Alaska the only taxing authority that this is being asked of?
Representative Dugan, through the chair, Alaska is the only entity, and it's because Alaska is the resource owner.
Thank you. We'll move to thanks for those questions that Representative Dugan, appreciate it. We'll move to Representative Samuels, and then we have Representative Olson following Ralph.
Thank you. I'm going to follow up on what Representative Dugan said. So if Canada came in and quintupled its property tax, that's not something that you're going to look at, because that also increases the tariff and reduces your netback and our netback as well. So that's not something that ExxonMobil would be pursuing, whether it be, and I have no idea how property taxes in Canada work, if it's a federal thing or if the federal government just created a new property tax. Is that something that you try to mitigate that risk also? And if I could follow up, it's the same question in a different form. I'm assuming you don't have leases on federal land in Alaska. Is that true?
You're testing me. I'm not sure.
Put yourself in Shell's shoes then. Can the federal government come in there and create a severance tax on federal land? Is that something that the producer, you're not going to speak for Shell, never mind, I'll ask him. Stick to the Canadians.
Yeah, Representative Samuels, through the chair, Obviously, we would like the Canadians to put a reasonable tax on the project. When you look at the magnitude of the tax bill associated with the project, the Canadian piece is relatively small. So the impact of it, you know, impacting the project in a negative way is not as significant as, you know, the state of Alaska. And the federal government, because they're not the resource owner at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, we do not feel it's appropriate to go to the federal government and ask for some sort of, you know, long-term fiscal terms related to that.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. So if we set up a process that Exxon said we can live with this process, whatever it was, and you alone, or you in consortium with a pipeline company, you teamed up with Mid-America or TransCanada or Enbridge, one of these guys, you got the bid, but now your partners don't want to bid gas into your pipeline. If you bid gas into your pipeline, can you take the gas from Prudhoe? Or let's say you and BP wanted to take gas, and Conoco said, no, I don't want them to take, I'm not going to ship my gas on Exxon's pipeline for whatever the reason is.
Yeah.
Can you ship gas to market, assuming that you could get enough gas off the slope to make something pay somewhere? Can you take that without your partners?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, it's been our belief that this project will not be a success unless the state of Alaska, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips are aligned. So it's never really entered our thought process of trying to do a project without all of us being aligned. To answer the question directly, there is the ability for an owner to within Prudhoe to take their own gas. It's complicated in that it has to be consistent with an approved plan, and the other owners would have to essentially agree that was an acceptable
thing. That turns into a no.
But I don't know if it turns it into a no, because maybe a situation where they would be okay with that. But it's not something, like I said, that we have really pursued or thought about. We just can't envision a project having success without all of us agreeing, and really do not want to start progressing a project until we have that agreement, because that, in our view, would be a recipe for failure.
One last question. As around the world, Mr. Massey, ExxonMobil bids gas into third-party pipelines. I'm assuming you don't really own that many miles of pipe. So around the world, you bid gas into third-party pipelines with no fiscal certainty. I don't know if you own leases in Wyoming or other gas provinces. They don't lock in their taxes. You just bid the gas into the third-party pipe. You pay the toll. If the people start to tax you too high, I'm sure you go lobby their legislatures or regulatory environments. So why us? What's the difference between us and everywhere else in the world that you do business? Why us? And then I'll ask my follow-up question in a second.
Okay. Representative Samuels, through the chair, you have to look at this project. This is a basin opening project. We've got the basin open to oil. Now we're talking about opening the basin to gas. And you can just go around the world. Any basin opening project has been done when there's alignment between the resource owner and the leaseholders. The upstream pays for the basin opening project, that infrastructure investment. And the risk is generally so high and the cost is so great that the leaseholder takes it on. As we talked about, this project, is going to not really compare to any other project. And the producer, the upstream shipper, if you will, is going to pay for this project through these FT commitments. And they're, you know, given the risk, On something of this magnitude, those taking the risk need to be able to manage the risk. And that theory has proven itself out, because if you go and look at basin opening projects, that's what has occurred. It hasn't been done by a third party. It's been done by the leaseholder.
Cover everything?
Go to Representative Olson, and followed by Representative Olson, go to Ramirez.
We've got three short ones for you, Marty. At the in your opening statement, you indicated that the 2001 estimate of the pipeline was approximately $20 billion. You gave us all the reasons why it had increased significantly, but unless I missed it, you didn't give us your current estimate on the cost.
Representative Olson, through the chair, and the reason I didn't give you a number is I don't have the confidence in a number right now.
Could you give us a spread?
Well, I would say to Chicago, it's over $30 billion.
That's close enough. Second question would be a key element of the administration's GEO plan is the $500 million incentive. With apologies to the administration, I think it's been described as the little blue pill for gas pipeline dysfunction and cure it and get it moving. But can you share your thoughts on the $500 million incentive?
Representative Olson, through the chair.
Bad vigil.
That's funny. That's funny. As I said earlier, the $500 million is not something that we proposed to the administration in our discussions going forward. It's not something that we find very leveraging on a project of this magnitude. So it's not something that's that important to us.
I did the math in my head, and I'll probably be corrected by somebody that can do it better than me, but it probably comes out to a week or two's net profits. So I can see why it might not be a major factor. But
what we would propose is let the applicant describe what's necessary to make the project viable. You may be surprised. There may be some that don't need any of the capital contribution, and that may work well for you. You may decide that's a better way to go. You may find some that need more than $500 million to get the project started. So
I guess my last question is, at this point in time, are you negotiating with the First Nations, since they may be a factor as we get further into the
process? Representative Olson, through the chair. We have primarily focused our efforts in Canada with the federal government there in terms of starting to think about the process that would be used to get the permits to go through Canada, including what process should be used to get the rights to go through the First Nations lands. We're beginning to establish some contacts there. But it's really not appropriate to do much of that work at this point until we know we have a project, because I really don't have anything to talk to them about at this point in time. Once we get the project, ready to go, then we'll have ample time to go to Canada, and I'm confident we'll get through Canada.
I'd like to thank you again for coming and participating. Mm-hmm. I'm done.
And again, congratulations on your DNA test results. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're running a great meeting today. Thank you. Marty, I'm so happy to see you. I just a couple of comments, and then I do have a question.
Promise?
Yes. I once had a staff meeting at my restaurant, and I said, what percentage of our revenue is generated by food and beverage? Because we're a restaurant. And it took the people sitting there a while to get it. And I said, I'll help you. 100%. 100%. That's what we do. That's all we do is food and beverage, excluding T-shirts or keychains or, little knickknacks. And so what I want to remind folks of is a couple of things. One is one of the greatest things that you said today that I want us to think about, that I'm going to think about at least, is that the upstream pays for the midstream. It's critical. Secondly, I want to talk about this vast earnings of ExxonMobil. It's used primarily for three things. They either save it into retained cash, they use it to develop gas and oil projects, or they buy back shares of Exxon stock. To all three of these things are combined to expand shareholder value. The third thing is, I don't want to concentrate, and my friend Representative Dahlstrom asked a question about how much you've invested in Alaska. But what's really material here is, how much are you investing globally, and how attractive is opening the Alaska Basin to gas exploration? Because, you know, one of the knocks on Exxon has been that we have been harvested for years. But one of the beautiful things is rotation. Sooner or later, it's going to be Alaska's turn, and I would say it's sooner, that it's now that we're going to see Exxon's earnings from around the globe to be repatriated to Alaska, that now is the time. And I think that this new governor with a new fresh approach, with a new complexion on ExxonMobil and a new can-do approach across the state, that now is the time. And so however much you've invested in Alaska, heck, that was yesterday. How much you're earning is all about how much of that capital can be applied to Alaska's growth. And opening that basin is about the next 50 years. And man, I squealed as loud as anybody in this room about fiscal certainty for 30 years. And we could wrestle in the mud about it. And I know you're like the Borg and resistance is futile because you are a giant, you're the country of Exxon. I understand all that. But I'm glad that you're here. And I'm supportive of 30 years I couldn't stand, 10 years I can hold my nose, I can go for 10 years, and I can look toward inducements to make this. I feel like Governor Palin can make a high school prom. She can get the ribbons out and the punch bowl and invite everybody to the dance, but we need to make these two folks, you know, meet and embrace in the middle of the floor, and that's the open season, and that's the critical thing. And so my question for you, so I can end with the question and not diminish my credibility, is can you with a few buzzwords to give us some direction for next week, tell us what the criteria should be. Big words, little words, I don't care, but tell us what you think the criteria should be so that it is not as subjective in selecting the applicant.
Representative Ramirez, through the chair, first off, it should be you got to pick somebody that can do the job, and that means do they have the financial strength? Second, what's been their project experience and their results that they have generated? You know, I would require the applicant to describe their experience, what are some of those similar projects that they've done, so that you have a good feel for their capability and the results that they've generated. Third would be their safety and environmental performance. I would require them to provide what are their safety results, what are their environmental results, what are their integrity performance, so that you have that information and you compare the applicants. And then last in that particular category, how are they going to ensure you that they get a successful open season? And then I would look at the second criteria, is how much money is this going to generate for the state? What is the value to the state? How much money are we going to get over the life of the project? And then last, I would look at how well they meet our other objectives. Does their plan provide for access to the gas? Does their plan provide for, you know, low-cost transportation of the gas here in Alaska? Does their plan provide for hiring Alaskans and putting them to work on the job? How well are they going to ensure you that the project can be expanded? And I would weigh all of those proposals up and then select the one that, in a general sense, meets those criteria.
Thank you, and I think a lot of us have written down, and actually we've concluded as a committee that really is the if not the crux of the bill, certainly one of the major aspects of it, and we are given that heavy emphasis. So for you to give us that feedback is very useful, and we appreciate it. Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got what I hope are just a couple of quick questions, Marty. I thought I heard you say that when you were talking about allowing the applicants to propose tax and royalty rates, I thought I heard you say oil and gas. Was that correct?
Representative Dugan, through the chair, yes.
Thank you. And also, when you said something to the effect of, I think our position on this is well known, were you referring to the terms of the contract that the previous administration had sent to the legislature under the Stranded Gas Act? Is that?
Representative Dugan, through the chair, that's one example of what would allow a successful project to go. That's probably not the only example. And we can go back and look at how we can, change those terms. But it is a good example in terms of what the bottom line revenue sharing that needs to occur between the state and the producers to make the project go.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Any more questions? I've got a lot of notes written down, and I can go on with questions for the next 2 hours myself, but I'll seek the answers from you perhaps through a subsequent meeting or something. But
be happy to do that.
And a lot of my questions have actually been answered as well, too. So I do thank you, Marty, for your presentation and for the questions and comments from the members, including Representative Rammers's very lively comments and observations, which add spice to our meetings. Appreciate that. Very thoughtful, I might add, but presented in a very interesting way. So I'd like to announce that we are going to continue with our series of hearings. Tomorrow will be the second half of our public hearing process, which will be a joint meeting with the Senate Resources Committee, and that will again be in the Senate Finance Committee room, and in room 520. Well, everybody knows where that is, whatever the number is. And I've just been reminded that Representative Dahlstrom wanted to have Commissioner Galvin come forth. Let me finish with my little announcement here, though, since I'm halfway through that. That'll be tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in the Senate Finance Committee joint meeting. So before we adjourn, if we could have Commissioner Galvin come forth. And Marty, again, thank you very, very much for the presentation, okay?
Thank you.
And for the other folks from Exxon here who've joined us, too. And my apologies for failing to recognize you at the onset of the meeting, but thank you for being here.
Okay, Commissioner Irwin is back, too.
Okay, both of us come up? Or?
Whatever is acceptable. Chair, I'd just like to hear some feedback from some of the comments that we've heard today, and if you have any comments that you would like to put on record.
For the record, my name is Pat Galvin. I'm Commissioner of Department of Revenue. I think that what we heard today was Exxon is clearly a hugely successful company, and they're successful for some very important reasons. They operate in a very rational and predictable manner. They have a very disciplined approach to making decisions, and they have a very successful track record at making those decisions in such a way that it maximizes the value to their shareholders. And what one of the things that I think we can all recognize and appreciate is that the Exxon message, as Marty indicated, is consistent. There's really no difference from what they're telling you today from what they've been telling the state really for a number of years. And I think we all recognize that when they itemize the things that they consider as their must-haves as part of this process. And we identified today fiscal certainty, and fiscal certainty isn't just on gas production taxes as allowed in AGEA, but as Marty indicated, we've got property tax, income tax, royalty rates, how the cost structure is going to affect the Exxon bottom line. And clearly that is their stated position. I believe that the recommendations with regard to changes to AGEA were also consistent with regard to their message. What he described was an opportunity for applicants to present what not only responding to what the state has identified, but the state to establish broad requirements and then have the applicants submit a proposal that would provide their picture on how they could meet those, and then the administration take those, decide which one, probably end up having to work to negotiate some of the finer points on that, given that there's not a lot of direction given in the initial legislation, and then bring something back to the legislature. And clearly that's the model of the Stranded Gas Development Act, which I think is one that they were comfortable with in terms of approach to dealing with the state. What I also appreciated was the discussion about the evaluation criteria, and the identified things that they recognize the state should be looking for. And I believe that those are consistent with what we've provided for, but clearly we need to work on that in order to provide a greater clarity so that the legislature feels that it does establish those base terms and what the state really needs to be looking at from the various applicants to select a project. I think the final observation is just a recognition that another reason why Exxon is so successful is they recognize in a negotiation leverage, positioning themselves so that they minimize competition, positioning themselves so that their position has the greatest advantage is clearly a path to success for them. And to the extent that in that evaluation criteria, from their perspective, the state requiring that an applicant must ensure a successful open season is an indication that only those with the gas can ensure a successful open season. And if and we've been, I think, extremely forthright with you that we're not expecting an applicant to be able to come in and ensure a successful open season. However, from the state's perspective, what we know is, as I think became clear from Marty's testimony, is we have a choice here. We've got what Exxon is asking for, and as Marty said, it establishes the previous contract establishes basically the fiscal expectations that Exxon would have. I don't think that it's a clear statement yet, because I think there's some working with the change in the PPT. We got some feedback from Exxon that they expected more value because of the PPT. I think it's all part of the same mix, but it gives you an idea of what the fiscal nature of their expectation. And on the other side, they went back to the standard of diligence. They shouldn't be held to any particular benchmarks requirements, but they should be held to be diligent, and that should go to a third party, as they said, not to the court system, to a third party. So the message is consistent, the request is consistent, their position is consistent, and our choice is somewhat consistent. We can decide to go down that path, or we can take a different path, which puts us in a different place some, you know, a year or two from now from where we are today. And that different place is going to be, in our opinion, beneficial for everyone. We're going to have a project. We're going to know what the parameters are. We'll be able to talk about these things in a different context than we are today because of the uncertainties that we all face right now in discussing the fiscal nature of this process. So I'll just close it with that. I don't know if Tom wanted to add anything.
Mr. Chair, I came forward to pay respect to you and to the committee.
Thank you.
I will make just a two-second comment. We have all experienced in life the great value of a little blue pill in removing gas, and that investment in our future can be worth its weight in gas.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you very much. That was, for the record, Commissioner Tom Irwin of DNR.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And Commissioner Galvin, thank you very much for your remarks. We'll go to Representative Ramirez.
Thank you. Commissioner, quick question.
Sorry.
I was visited. The Governor Palin changes her stance on Port Authority, was above the fold in the Daily News Miner a few days ago. And I'm from Fairbanks, and we're very sensitive to the whole Alaska line up there. Didn't even make the Anchorage Daily News as a story, but that's some of the regional issues. Did it, Representative Dahlstrom?
Yesterday.
I got visited by Paul Fuchs because I suggested that the Port Authority project, although it's viable and it's economic, is not affected by the FERC letter. I said, so what? So it made it a little less economic. It's not a top-tier project anyway, because we continue to talk about the 4 BCF a day line to Alberta and Chicago. And one of the great things that Pedro Van Mieris did say was we got to be mindful of the nibbler effect, that we have a nibbler projects that take away from the large project right out of the box. So here's what Mr. Foose told me in my office. He said there's not enough gas. He said nobody's talking to the AOGCC. There's not enough gas because of the reinjection required up in Prudhoe, that there's not enough gas to do a 4 BCF a day pipe, and that we should do the 2 BCF a day pipe that goes down to Valdez. So very quickly, is he right or wrong?
I'd first like to comment through the chair to Representative Ramrest. I think the governor's position at that period of time, and she clearly said it in the article, she was not privileged to the confidential behind closed doors negotiations that were going on. And the process to move gas to market at that time, that was the only open one. Mm-hmm. The governor, and the reason I am so pleased to be working for her, she's standing up to do what's right for Alaskans and what's fair. So I want to really go on the record for that, and that's what Alaska needs. You want to hit Paul?
Yeah. Thank you. I think Representative Ramirez through the chair. The issue of how much gas is available is one that we spoke to at a previous hearing, and I think that the answer is we just don't know. And the identification that we had at that time, we had a slide that we talked about the Prudhoe situation, and there is an offtake issue. And I read to you from the AOGCC staff recommendation that at this point in time, there is no request to look further at the previous decades-old order with regard to the 2.7 BCF a day offtake. We intend to look at that further. We're a little disappointed, surprised that the producers, given all the work that has been done, haven't asked for that clarification either, particularly given the size of the line that they were pursuing. But we, I think, have a certain amount of confidence that between the Point Thompson resource that we know is there, the Prudhoe Bay unit that has the opportunity to take off gas, and the exploration that's taking place, there's enough gas to fill a number of different projects, but that does need to be looked at closer.
What a relief. Mr. Chairman, can you...
It's no longer.
Very quickly.
Robin Thompson is gone.
Okay. Commissioners, can you go over and can you augment Marty Massey's list of... because we're pretty intent on doing an amendment that will include criteria so that the methodology isn't so subjective and doesn't invite litigation, as Marty suggested. Can you quickly give us some pointers on what those criteria ought to be in your mind if we put them into amendment form as part of the AGIA proposal, please?
Representative Ramirez, to the chair, if I might ask the chair's situation on that, we are clearly working with the resource or this committee. Mm-hmm. We're preparing that list and we'll be making it available. We also feel it's very important. Mm-hmm. As a side comment, I've said many times how much I respect the capabilities of the various companies. I want to remind everyone that their financial obligations or duties are to maximize every bit of value to them. Our job as administration, and I know you all respect it as a legislative body, is to make sure we have good business decisions on all sides, and we're here to protect the business side of the state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I wanted to follow up on some things that Mr. Massey said on the listing out the exact numbers, and I've got another scenario for you. I know you'd be excited. The producers, all three, come forward with a proposal, and you get every single thing in here you want. We don't change a word of the bill, everything in here you want, but they say, we run our numbers, and we just can't go above 14% on that maximum, above the recourse rate. It's a non-conforming bid, and you have to throw it out by statute. So everything you get, and you get the gas. They come forward and they say, you know, sign in blood. I'll give you the gas. You get everything in here you want, but I just can't go above 14%. And I think that's the problem that I've got in my mind. I can think of a million examples in here where it's, you got it listed out there, And instead of going, well, we can make up the 1% over here, or the 5, or the, you know, we can do something on a tax, we can do something here. If they come in, it is a non-conforming bid and is thrown in the trash, and now we have a different applicant is chosen. But now we have, once again, you don't have the gas at the open season. Maybe you do, maybe you do not. Maybe you have the second failed open season. And it's the same question that I've asked you, Pat, for since we started this process. So I don't need an answer to the question, because there is no answer to the question. But that's the problem. I understand. I've heard you loud and clear on why you did this. But the downside of that is the 14% question. What happens? You can't accept the bid that has the gas with it. It is non-conforming, and back to the legislature you come again. And so there's a couple other questions on the tax rate that I should have asked Mr. Massey. I understand, you know, if I were ExxonMobil and a third party came to me, I'd say, in your bid, you better include zero tax, because that's the only thing I want. And then lo and behold, they wouldn't get the bid either, and I'd get the bid also. So I understand the dynamic, but it is a problem with listing things so much just in absolute black and white. And it doesn't matter what number you pick. If you pick 10, they might come in and say, I can do it for 9. And they might be serious, that they might have run their economics, and 9 is as high they can go, and your number was 10. And I'm not saying that anybody's trying to game anybody, but when they run their economics, their number comes out at 9, or their number comes out at 4, and you don't,
yeah,
you don't know it. It becomes problematic.
Representative Samuels through the chair. Yeah, I really.
Both been called worse.
Well, you two have been sitting there together talking so much, I guess it wasn't a disrespectful comment. No, I think we've all very carefully considered those discussions. What your question is doing, in my line of thinking, is really diminishing the capabilities of all these very large companies, whether they be these producers or others. And there are multiple ways to get around issues in a response. And if a participant, whether producer or pipeline company, really wants to work in Alaska and move the project forward, if it really is of their interest, and we've heard it clearly from the parties, then I really believe in their presentation they will get around those issues, my feeling.
Representative Samuels, to the chair, what we recognized is just coming into trying to solve this problem when we began our evaluation back December 4th was how do we engage in trying to reach some sort of understanding with the various parties that are at play here. And one of the limitations that we have to recognize is that as a public entity, we don't have the same flexibility able to sit down and dynamically work through a project and resolve these issues. The discussion is relatively blunt, formal, and somewhat necessarily rigid, because we all have to collectively make a certain decision to move this thing forward. And so it, to some extent, it's incumbent on us collectively as we establish what the initial request is going to be to ensure that those requests are commercially reasonable. That's, I mean, from our standpoint, that we have to make sure that they're commercially reasonable. And when we ask for the response back, we similarly expect the applicant to recognize that same limitation, that they can't come in and try to basically dicker us down on one particular term or another. That's not the nature of that type of dialogue. If they end up, you know, frankly, we know these numbers are huge, and we also recognize that at this particular point in time, there's all kinds of assumptions and various sub-numbers, sub-assumptions of those assumptions. And so it's extremely unlikely that anybody's going to analyze this project and say, if we got a rolled-in rate of 12% instead of 15%, then it's a go. If it's 15%, it's a no-go. That's just not where we're going to end up. There's just too many other moving parts that have too many other ranges of of possible of assumption. And so what we're trying to establish here is a general framework for what the state's asking for, and we believe that we're within the ballpark for the commercial world out there to participate in this project, and we need to see what we get back.
I don't want to end it in a debate for an hour on this thing, but the 14% was an example I used, but it could be very realistic that your tariff is $3, and you say, and instead you go, look, I'll go back up to the $3. I agreed to pay the $3, but paying more than that, I don't want to pay. But if you want to pay at the state, do something with the tax over here. So, but once you say it's a 15, it's 15. So that's the 14 was just an example I used. Yeah. That I don't picture that happening, but I could picture a lot of other things just like that happening through the process. Is I can't give you this, but I can give you that. But you can't do that in the bid.
So. The committee looks like they're getting ready to leave. We still have about 2 more hours to go, but. Just kidding. Okay, I'd like to wrap it up. And again, thanks for everybody's participation. And we look forward to seeing you at the public hearing tomorrow with the Senate Resources, followed by BP's presentation to this committee on Monday. So with that, we'll adjourn at 10:09.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.